Welcome to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free call-in number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. Or, if you're currently, recently, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. Have you ever seen a story on the news about how wonderful homeless people are? Well, homeless people haven't seen one either. Why are media images of homeless people so negative? And what impact do these media creations have on the lives of the real flesh and blood people struggling on the streets? We'll take a look at media, menace, and mendacity right after this.
Do y'all know my name?
J.L. Bennett.
No, it's not. Herbert R. Bennett Jr.
Don't ever call me Herbert.
He prefers to be called J.R. He's sitting at a table at the Coalition for the Homeless in downtown Manhattan. He and the other students in the room are part of the Coalition's youth advocacy group. They meet weekly to work on raising awareness about homelessness. They feel comfortable here talking about being homeless, something they can't do with just anyone.
Today's topic is going to be education while being in a shelter system.
Today, JR, the founder of the group, is leading a conversation about school.
First day of high school, my mom went to my guidance counselor, so that was fun.
DeAndra K. Atkinson is 16.
And I had a lecture about how even though I'm homeless, I can still do great and I can get everything done, and I didn't. So they would say that, oh, you could have done it if you really wanted to. And I'm like, how?
Homeless students across the country have to deal with more than the usual difficulty of growing up in poverty. Along with the stress and instability of moves from shelter to shelter, they often have to negotiate long commutes. Frequent moves also make it difficult to keep school records straight, and even basic things like supplies and uniforms are hard to come by. And then there are the relationships with teachers and the other students.
How exactly were y'all treated by like people that knew that you were homeless?
They talk about it constantly.
That's 14-year-old Von Bathia.
They make fun of us, saying that we can't afford anything, we can't afford housing, can't afford clothes and stuff.
They used to get in my face, they'd be telling me, oh, you ugly, you dirty, you this and that.
Isis is 13. She's Von's sister. They just moved out of the shelter system into an apartment in the Bronx. They were homeless for more than 2 years.
When I was homeless, my attitude was really on the tip of aggravated.
Homeless students are caught in a bind. Ideally, a teacher would know their situation and would provide extra time for them to complete projects if they miss school. But at the same time, the kids don't really want anyone to know.
Let's face it, kids are cruel to other kids.
Agnes Stevens is a retired teacher in Los Angeles. She founded School on Wheels 11 years ago, a nonprofit that provides educational assistance to homeless students through tutoring and other services.
I've seen it work greatly when a teacher is aware of children coming from a shelter, but I've seen it far too often where nobody knows and there is that mistrust on all sides.
Some of the teachers want to, like, you know, because of the fact that you're homeless, it's like, we understand your situation, and it's like, well, I'm no different than the other kids in the class. I guess I feel like it's kind of like talking down to me. It's like, you know, it's okay, you're homeless. It shouldn't be that way. It's like, we are going through something different, but other kids in the class, like, feed off of that. Like, why is he getting an extension, you know? Is it because he's homeless?
I had to go to different schools to finally finish the fifth grade.
That's Vaughn again.
I tried to finish fifth grade in one school year. We was forced to move to another shelter. Then I tried again, and I was almost there. It was almost June, then we had to move again.
According to the McKinney-Vento Act, a federal law protecting the rights of homeless students, these kids are allowed to stay in their school of origin, where they were before becoming homeless. School districts are obligated to help them do that, but not everyone is informed of this right. If they do decide to stay, their schools can be far away from their shelter, and they have trouble making it to school on time, or making it at all, and they're exhausted with negotiating the system.
A lot of times, like, I know I slept during school. That was my time to sleep.
You over here, like, slouching in the table and everything, they'd be like, what's wrong with you, Isis? And then you'd say, oh, I didn't sleep last night.
I think for a teacher, it's kind of frustrating because they maybe don't come in with their work or they're out a lot of times and that kind of thing.
Agnes says that in Los Angeles, public schools are already overburdened, as are most urban school systems in the U.S. Add in homeless students, there are 800 in downtown L.A.'s Skid Row alone, It's a lot to deal with for overworked teachers.
The classroom teacher really, when our tutors get a hold of them, they really want to help. I think it's just the conflict and the frustration of people not knowing where people are coming from.
Since I've gotten into high school, I've really begun to like school a lot because I felt comfortable there. Like, I dread going to my shelter.
JR lives with his father and was first homeless when he was 4. In 2002, he became homeless again, at the end of his first year in high school.
I feel like my only escape out of the shelter system right now is college. Most of the colleges I applied to was out of New York State. I don't want to be in New York City anymore. I don't know, there's too many bad memories. I just want to leave it.
In New York, this is Sarah Elzis. This piece was produced with Sarah Kramer.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Nobody, and welcome back to the Homelessness Marathon, the 8th annual Homelessness Marathon. We're the numbers to call in. If you're anybody at all, you can call 877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody and the number 8. And if you are homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, we have a second number you can also call in. That's 866-LEFT-OUT. Now, my co-hosts for this hour are Chance Martin, who is the editor of Street Sheet in San Francisco, and Tom Boland, who is the founder of the Homeless People's Network, which exists in cyberspace online, but Tom, I happen to know, lives in Boston, so we're spanning the country. Chance and Tom, welcome to the marathon.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, our topic this hour is media menace and mendacity. I thought that was kind of a good term phrase myself. And so let me ask you, okay, I'm going to start with you, Chance, since you're running a big media empire out there in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Street Sheet is the homeless paper of San Francisco. But you have that other little thing, that little rag called the Chronicle out there.
Yeah.
And how would you characterize the images of homeless people that you see in the Chronicle, in the media in San Francisco, and also, I guess, in the national media?
Well, you know, there was a series in the Chronicle that led up to a local welfare reform measure called Care Not Cash. And the series in the Chronicle was called Shame of the City. And I guess what we really reacted most to in the imaging and the messaging was that first off, there was many lurid photos of people with crack pipes in their mouths and getting ready to shoot heroin, and it was just like pervasive through all the photos that accompanied these pieces, and the pieces were pointing to this Care Not Cash measure that our then supervisor, now mayor, Gavin Newsom, hitched his political star to and rode right into the mayor's office.
And what is Care Not Cash?
Care Not Cash is a local welfare reform measure. Basically, what it did was it cut people's cash grants, people, single adult welfare recipients, by 85% to about $59 a month. And in return for that, the voters were promised that they would be given housing and treatment services. And then when the city started implementing Care Not Cash, we come to find out that shelter beds are considered housing. So basically they're cutting people's checks by $59, and if they want to remain enrolled in the welfare program, they have to take a shelter bed.
Now, this was about 2 or 3 years ago those articles came out, as I recall.
Yeah.
And I was in San Francisco when they came out, just by coincidence. I was working there, and I met with Paul Bowden, who founded San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness, which Street Sheet is under that aegis. And I remember when I saw those pieces being deeply shocked, because I am a journalist, and I thought that was some of the sleaziest daily journalism I had seen in my life.
Well, you know, the really troubling part is that the reporter, Kevin Fagan, and the photographer, Brant Ward, both won Excellence in Journalism Awards for the coverage.
But speaking as somebody who actually has studied this issue, and you have as well, of course, you've lived it, I mean, it was disgusting, and it was really fake. And as you point out, it was geared towards promoting something that the city wanted to enact.
It was geared toward promoting fear,
yep,
of homeless people.
So that they could make a legislative change.
Right. And actually, after the voters passed it, there were legislative challenges to it that somehow the city attorney overcame, but based on the California Welfare and Institutions Code, that only elected boards of supervisors for the county could change the way welfare benefits,
right,
are accomplished. And basically that was because the reason why they framed that in the California Welfare and Institutions Code was to prevent discriminated minorities from being voted in the general election. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm not being so clear. But you know, if there's any group, you know, that is a discriminated minority, it doesn't have to be homeless people. The
homeless people are just lucky.
That there's a legislative effort to govern just them.
Right.
You know, it's illegal. But
well,
the city attorney prevailed. Maybe he'll prevail on the gay marriage fight, too.
Well, all right. Let's move across the continent here. Tom?
Yes.
We were talking about San Francisco. Now, San Francisco does have the reputation of being one of the three scuzziest, nastiest, cruelest cities in the entire United States as far as homeless people are concerned. Boston, however, and Cambridge have the reputation not as being paradise. No, there is no paradise for the homeless, but certainly much more benign cities. Do you see a difference in the media coverage where you are?
Well, I think there may be. The Boston Globe, for instance, generally frames homeless people as poor workers in need, as sort of sorry cases, sometimes people with personal deficits like addiction or emotional stress, what the paper might describe as mentally ill. And so a lot of the focus is on the personal dysfunctions or perceived personal dysfunctions of the homeless people that the Globe reports. But they also talk about housing and housing programs and living wages and some of the other social and economic issues like rents that affect it. So I'd say their reporting is certainly better than the San Francisco Chronicle's, or Chronicle, as they claim.
Do you think that the reporting, because we're talking now, San Francisco's reporting is perhaps dictated to some extent by the agenda of the city. Do you think the more benign attitudes in the Boston area of the politicians reflect in the press, or do you think it's just a coincidence that the press is maybe a little better and the government also?
I'm not sure exactly of the reasons why there's a difference between San Francisco and Boston reporting. Both cities have a history of progressive activism and of liberalism, which we have here as well in the Boston-Cambridge area. I think there's enough people who are within the power structure who have a social welfare state perspective on what helps, Kennedy types, you might say. There's enough people in the power structure that the reporting and the policing and some of the programs are a little better than you might find elsewhere.
Well, you know, also, I do want to interject here, by the way. I think San Francisco is a great city, but I don't want to be knocking San Francisco as a city. But I personally, because everybody said, oh, it was terrible in the days of Haight-Ashbury, but I'd rather have the city run by hippies than run by real estate barons, if it was up to me. We got a lot to talk about, but we got a caller. William is on the line, who's been waiting for a while. Those numbers again, 877-NOBODY-8 or 866 Left Out. William from Cleveland, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hello, how are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Well, it's our pleasure. What's on your mind tonight?
Oh, nothing. I've been homeless for 15 years, and I find it admirable what you're doing, and the points you're mentioning are very important, that the people that are homeless, they're not all drug addicts, and they're not all, you know, mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was in my life, I was classified illegally as having a mental illness. And that was as to permit, I was a victim of psychotherapy in 1990. I had owned a beautiful home in Cincinnati, working with my brother's company. My life was definitely doing good, but somebody had decided that they wanted to do involuntary psychotherapy on me, which if you go into any, if you go into the Encyclopedia of Associations, which at times are two huge books, and look under psychiatry and psychology, there are millions upon millions of dollars, federally funded dollars, flowing down into local communities for the research into psychotherapy, many different types of psychotherapy. Read many books on it. The type that was intervened and forced upon my life was more towards behavioral modification, and I even linked it back to the psychotherapies that were that was being done in the 1940s under human experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, they tamper with your life. And Dorothy Tenno, she's a psychotherapist out of Connecticut, wrote a book in the 60s, The Hazards of Psychotherapy, extraordinary book. Everybody should read
it. Did you ever read any of Peter Bregan's stuff?
No, I have not. The one book that I really... that really got me going, and really, I was trying to contact 60 Minutes, and when Jill Lander was executive producer out of 60 Minutes, when I was contacted, I was living in California, and psychotherapy, as I said, started in 1990. I owned a beautiful home. I just wanted to drive a truck and keep my home because I'd left my brother's company because the family, youngest of nine kids, the family kind of made the decision too. Being the youngest of nine, they came together and kind of said, well, we kind of agree with this too. And my whole being was my father had passed away and he co-signed for home. My whole responsibility to my father was to keep my home, to keep responsible and this and that. And I wanted to drive a truck to do that when I left my brother's company. Well, that was illegally derailed. And literally at that point, it became a fight for my life to just do what I wanted to do. But in some types of psychotherapy, that doesn't apply. Dorothy Tenov, in fact, on the cover of her book, spoke of insidious domination of these therapists. And
well, you know, William, I can't go into all your cases. I want to say, because I'm well aware that there is, and we've talked about it on this show before,
there is
a burgeoning psychiatric survivor movement. There is a lot of people who say out there that there's a lot of people who think that the drug companies and the psychiatrists have got too much power over our lives. But I can't comment on your individual case except to say that, yes, I'm aware there are a lot of psychiatric injustices out there and a lot of people are very up in arms about it.
Well, she even wrote, I mean, like I said, if anybody were to go into the Encyclopedia of Association and just look under the two headings of psychiatry and psychology, pages upon pages upon pages upon pages of local mental facilities receiving federally funded dollars or basically human experimentation.
Let me ask you this, Kevin.
And this is criminal. These are crimes being committed because these people are tricked into signing something or this or that, that, you know, and once they sign and once they're part of this psychotherapy, involuntary psychotherapy, she spoke of where it can go on endlessly.
Let me make another quick point, which is that homeless people are also often the guinea pigs for psychiatric drugs. Because they go into these studies to make a little money or whatever, and that's the only option they've got. I've got to let you go because I got other people on the line and stuff, but I want to ask you one question before I let you go, William.
Sure.
Which is, in your life, the media images of homeless people, what effect have they had on you?
Living in California, when I was, the police had taken a very negative approach on me, and they did not understand. I tried to convey the message I was fighting for my life, because I knew I was going to be physically harmed. And ultimately, the dictating environment within my life led to, I have five ruptured discs now.
Right.
I currently have hundreds of contractions in both my calves, 24 hours a day from the ruptured disc. I received $1,000 and no future medical required out of the courts of California as workers' compensation. So there was definitely tampering going in my life. And during that point where I was literally fighting for my life, I knew I was going to be harmed. And the police finally said, well, this guy's just a work, you know, they finally realized, and they did. They saw me as a homeless
person.
All
right. So
and it was the media
image.
Exposing or creating this image of what the homeless person is, as to what I relate is how I was treated on the streets. But then there was a realization that, hey, this guy's just trying to work. Yeah, I go to work, and I work 24 hours a day, and I was trying to save money. So I can prevent what was coming down the pipe, which I wasn't able to.
Well, William, I want to thank you very, very much for the call, and I want to wish you the very best with your medical conditions and getting housing. Thank you. All right. Those numbers to call in again here are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Now, we have another caller on the line. I don't want to prejudice this in any way. I just want to say this caller identifies himself as being from that execrable anti-homeless yellow journalistic rag, the San Francisco Chronicle. Kevin, are you there?
Yeah, this is Kevin Fagan. I'm a reporter at the Chronicle.
Are you the one who was involved with that series, right?
Well, it depends on which series you're talking about. Yeah, I was involved in a 5-day series in December, November 2003, then another series in December this last year.
Well, Kevin, you're not talking to friends now, so what is your excuse for what you did?
My excuse. I was going out and trying to do an honest, unflinching, as you could say it, portrayal of what life was like for people living in the streets.
Well, Kevin, let me tell you something. As a journalist, when I saw that work, I was ashamed for my profession.
Oh, no kidding.
I thought that was
too bad.
Terrible.
That's
terrible
too bad,
work.
I was,
Chance,
you
want to talk to Kevin? Tell him what was wrong with the series.
I think the more salient question to ask Kevin Fagan right now is what happened to the article about the homelessness marathon?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well,
because that's the factor, too, is the discussion, the discourse becomes very one-sided.
Frankly, Chance, at this point, I'm not sure I want Kevin writing about us.
Piece in over the weekend, yeah. Right? And and you know, I sent Kevin your press release and the ode to burnt sienna.
Well, people don't know what that is, but go on.
I thought it was pretty clever, the ode to burnt sienna.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, Kevin's a decent guy. I am not going to sit here and demonize this man.
Well, I will.
No, thanks, Jim.
All right.
I appreciate that.
I'll do it. I'll demonize you, Kevin. I thought you were reporting
stuff. You don't know me, mate.
No, but I saw your reporting. It wasn't any good. You did a terrible job.
I had a very good friend die very prematurely, and Kevin wrote an article about it, and he handled it with some...
All right, Kevin, I'm going to be serious. I'm going to lay off. But I'm telling you, Kevin, what was missing from your reporting that I saw, I didn't see every piece. Let me be honest. I didn't see every one of the series. But I was,
because I've written about 100 over the last year.
I'm not denying. I'm not
going
to claim. I want to be, you know, I've been kidding around a little and going over the top. But I don't want to say anything I don't authoritatively believe. But I did not think that your reporting was from a position of sympathy with the people on the streets. You seem to be taking the view of the ruling powers that be, who really wanted to diss the people on the streets, and that seemed to be the perspective you were taking. There was no interior logic in your pieces of, you know, who are these people, why are they struggling? All the things I am putting myself on the line to bring out seemed in this broadcast seemed to be missing from your pieces.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm not sure exactly what story you looked at, because the thing that I was proud of, actually, in doing in the stories that I've been allowed to go at length on, is looking into why people wound up the way they did. You know, what kind of issues they had in their lives that led them to be on the street. And how living on the street is no damn picnic.
Well, Kevin, I mean, haven't you just said exactly the criticism I'm making? Why would you be putting only the issues in their lives? Why not talk about the evisceration of the funds for low-income housing, the tearing down of low-income housing in cities for urban renewal, in quotes? Why are you only focusing on, well, what's wrong in their lives, which is a fake slant to begin with?
Oh, well, I think all those things come into play. The you know, the massive cutbacks when Reagan was lionized as a great you know, the great communicator when he died. I think I was one of the only reporters in the nation who wrote a story saying that a lot of people blame him for the rise of homelessness in the 80s. I mean, I was there in the 80s covering it.
Did you blame him in your pieces? Not in his obit, in your pieces from the streets about homelessness, did you say we have homelessness because of Ronald Reagan? We have homelessness because of cuts. We have homelessness because of greedy real estate speculators buying up poor people's housing and trying to make it into rich people's housing. Is this what you wrote?
I've talked about how the lack of affordable housing has a hell of a lot to do with homelessness. Yeah, yeah. And the dismantling of the mental health system has a lot to do with it. How there's not enough support for poor people to get into housing that's actually worth something and that they can live in and they can afford. All those things come into play. And then the personal issues in people's lives do, too. You know, it's all a continuous thing. It's a whole set of factors that drive someone into the street. It's not an easy thing to do at all. And one thing I have not liked in the media in the past is stories that are two-dimensional or one-dimensional that just show, you know, oh, poor Joe sitting on the street.
Okay.
Let's give him a handout and everything will be okay. That has made me and my partner, Brant Ward, the photographer, it made us really sick over the years. And so what we wanted to do was go out and do something with some more depth. And the trouble is, no matter how much in depth you get in a story, someone's always going to find something that you should have put in. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I've been called a shill for the man, and I've been called some, you know, dumb suck hippie. I get it from all sides.
Do you know the fact that you get it?
As Chance knows.
Chance is one of the ones giving it to you, huh? Chance, is he telling the truth? Do you think Kevin's telling the truth? Did he really do a sympathetic job or even an honorable job, in your opinion, of covering this?
I think he did a very honorable job.
Okay.
I think, I don't know the give and take between Kevin and his editors. Okay, I don't know what parts died on the floor and what parts were told to be stuck in there.
It's hard to tell.
Chance, aren't these the same pieces you were just telling me 5 minutes ago weren't any good?
What I was saying was that they served to foment a lot of fear between people who are housed and homeless people.
Well, what's honorable
because
about that?
By focusing on these personal deficits in these folks, We help reinforce the idea that somehow they are different than us, and we are them.
Can I make a couple comments from the hub of the universe?
Yes, from Boston,
sure,
please do. We've left you out a little because you're not a San Franciscan here. Well, neither am I.
There you go.
You know, when I looked at the national media coverage of homelessness and presented it with some of the people in the street paper movement to college students at various campuses, what we found is pretty much the image of the predatory poor person, the crack addict in the abandoned housing who's going to rape your daughter, doesn't want to work, and is probably psychotic. And unless they're in prison, and it seemed like a lot of the articles that I read seemed to be PR for either the pharmaceutical or the prison industries. They were pretty much saying, what we need to do with these dangerous Egyptian slaves or Roma gypsies or queers in Germany, or in this case, homeless people here. These outsiders are endangering us, and we must kill, contain, or sedate them. And so people were presented as endangering. It was a spectral image of the very poor, which is actually very ancient and certainly has permeated the media and the coverage of people of color, for instance. And that's been mitigated somewhat by the civil rights movement, and the poor people's movements perhaps have somewhat mitigated the presentation of poor people as endangering. But the basic template is, unless we get these people outside of the business districts, we won't make money, and our children won't be safe when they're going to Yale or the University of San Francisco, or San Francisco State, I'm sorry, or to Harvard. They won't be safe unless we contain these people. And one of the key problems, aside from the hate that image can engender, oh, these people are predators, let's set them on fire on a park bench with kerosene, or let's put them in prison, or let's put them in a shelter, which one person, at least on the show, characterized as low-intensity incarceration, and there is some merit to that. We are policing the poor now. We're not supplying material needs to the poor, and the social policy is based in part on the media representations that help frame poor people as outsiders who need containing rather than family members who deserve help.
It is a challenge as to how you portray homeless people. I think anyone would admit that. It's one thing I try to do is I look for the good parts in people, too. You know, we're talking about the personal issues people deal with. I also like to look for the triumphs they have in overcoming the obstacles in front of them. And then the difficulties they have in trying to keep going when things are stacked against them. In this series I did in December, I talked about people who got into housing and then how hard it is to stay in the housing once they're in it and to get by on the small checks that they get through the welfare system or whatever entitlement system they're in.
I know, when I read that piece, Kevin, you could have knocked me over with a feather.
It was
counterintuitive to everything that's been coming out of the Kron, because in large measure, I mean, you know, and we're in the midst of it today with the homeless count, a big victory for Care Not Cash. And I'm sorry, but we were only talking about 2,700 people out of anybody's guess. You know?
Yeah, thousands.
Thousands.
Let me ask you a question. I believe me, I like talking to you because we don't get the enemy on this show very often. I'm sorry. We don't get.
And you know what?
Kevin's not the enemy.
We don't get reporters on this show very often. Never mind. You know.
That's okay. I understand the rhetoric.
Okay.
It's okay.
All right, Kevin. Let me ask you this. It is pretty well universally acknowledged among homelessness advocates who are paying attention that San Francisco is just a rotten, mean city to homeless people. It always is in the top three when the National Coalition puts out its list of the meanest cities. Is this reflected?
Yeah, I've noticed that, yeah.
Yes, is this reflected in the reporting in the Chronicle?
Well, I've talked about the anti-panhandling efforts by the city, how the police have gone out and moved people around, and how mostly what it's, a lot of what has happened in the last year is people have been moved from one area to another. Ping-ponging is one of the terms that I've certainly heard get used.
Mm-hmm.
I try to reflect that. I try to look at the thing from all sides. I don't consider myself an enemy or sycophant to anyone.
Have you ever written a story, Kevin, San Francisco is viewed as a really mean city and this is why? Have you ever written that story?
Yeah, I did. I did a story on the survey, the last survey that came out, saying that it was placing San Francisco among the meanest cities against homeless people. I covered that when it came out.
Yep.
Okay. I'm just asking.
I think I was one of the only mainstream guys to do it. Is that right, Chance? Pretty much,
Kevin. No, Kevin does cover the beat, you know, and to his credit, it's just the timing and some of the tone of the articles. I don't know, maybe it was the order that they ran them in, but you know, they just left people feeling really cold and alienated from homeless people.
Yeah, I can appreciate the I can understand the interpretation of that.
Yeah.
I think I get it from all sides. I have to say that in the more than 1,000 letters I got after that series ran a year ago, a lot of people were, you know, told me that they cried when they read it and they felt it made them feel like homeless people were human beings more than they'd ever felt before.
Yeah.
I was trying to present them as, trying to present people as human beings. I took extra effort to spend enough time to figure out, or to try to at least figure out, who the people were that I was writing about. I didn't want to do some one or two dimensional thing. And I had a lot of readers respond to that. And I had some of the homeless people I'd gone out and talked to and the subjects in my stories respond that way too. I mean, some of them, when they saw their pictures and stories in black and white on, you know, on the front page,
right,
were a little freaked, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them.
Yeah.
But I gotta say, I still talk to everyone I've covered. You know, mm-hmm. I run into them in the street all the time, and I care for them. They're humans.
Yeah.
That's one thing that, you know, I think it's easy to think when you look at some portrayals of homeless people in media, you think that people are just using them as cheap subjects, you know. And Brant and I, there's no way in hell we think that the homeless people are just cheap subjects. You know, we'd like nothing better than to see everyone get better lives for themselves and not have to live in the damn sidewalk, you know, taking handouts. I don't think anyone enjoys that at all. I think
it goes back to something that Jeremy was talking about, and something I'm sure that Paul and I've said to you before too, is that how any one of us became homeless isn't the story. How any one of us got out of homelessness isn't the story. The story is all these factors that converge to make so many people in this country homeless.
Yeah, I agree that that all these factors play into it.
Well,
yeah, and it's hard in one story. I mean, if you're going to cover all the overreaching factors in a comprehensive way each time, you're going to miss the small ones. If you're going to cover the small ones, you're going to miss some of the overreaching ones. It's hard to do all these things in each cut.
Yeah.
Each take at the problem.
Well, Kevin, you know, I got to kind of cut this off because, unfortunately, as much fun as I may be having, people around the country have not seen new reporting to have an opinion on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't actually know a lot about what we're talking about. But let me just ask you one or two questions, and then I'm going to have to let you go, although I do appreciate your call, and I understand that you want to defend your work.
Okay, I appreciate you having me on. I do. And
okay.
Chance, thanks for letting me know about this. I did write something, and I think, and I know that for space they cut it. They cut a bunch of stories because they run out of space.
Tell me this quickly, Kevin. How much pressure do you get? What do your editors tell you at the San Francisco Chronicle when they go out and send you out on the beat? Chance raised the question, what gets cut? What would you say are the constraints you're under at the Chronicle?
Well, I guess a lot of it is space. Is space, because, you know, if I take a 20-minute walk outside the Chronicle, I could probably come back with five stories. There's amazing things that go on in the homeless world. You know, things that are wrong all the way back to federal policy, state policy, things that are wrong on the street, you know, all kinds of things. And there's just only so much space, because I'm competing for space with all the other issues that go on.
Are you claiming there's no bias in their cuts? That they just cut what? They just cut at random? No, they cut according to some template.
No, yeah, I don't think there's. I don't think they just cut at random, and I do think there's not any malice at all. In fact, the Chronicle. I think I'm the only guy in the country right now assigned to the full-time homeless beat. Our editors actually do give a damn about the problem. They care about the people out there.
Okay.
And they've given me more room than anyone I've seen to cover the subject. But still, I mean, I could write reams on the thing, and there just isn't the space for it.
Well, Kevin, if I had known you were calling, I would have had some of your pieces here in front of me to ask you about. But
well, that's okay. I appreciate talking to you. I do.
I appreciate your call, and I think you're lucky you got Chance sticking up for you and saying you're an honorable guy. I have to say I did not like what I saw. That's just the truth. I didn't like what I saw, but I believe you, and I believe Chance when you say that they say you've done a lot of other things. And really, that's all I can say, because people out there don't know what you've written, and I don't have anything in front of me to quote. But
it's okay. You can go to sfgate.com and fish around till you find my byline. And they have a logo that I did not invent called Shame of the City, which is meant to imply that it's a shame that people have to live like this.
It comes from the title of a book by Lincoln Steffens called The Shame of the City. That's where it comes
the
from.
The Shame of the City?
Yeah, that's
it. Well, thank you very much.
That's what it's from.
I just have to say one thing, too. I very much appreciate Chance being around. I've known Chance quite a few years now and called on him as a source for many stories, and I've always found him to also be an honorable man. And a very knowledgeable guy, too, and a good guy at that.
Well, all right. We all love each other here, and I want to thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the job offer.
I was actually going to offer my consulting services on the pieces if they'd come up with my fee. Tom, would you like to insult some reporter from Boston so we can get another call?
Sure. There's a guy named Howie Carr, who a columnist for the Boston Herald, which is sort of like the scandal sheet of the area, and when some women on welfare went to the State House to protest welfare cuts, his byline was welfare queens quit whining.
Ooh.
So you do find in the Herald, for instance, some of this casting of poor people as derelict of duty or bums.
What was this guy's name again?
Say it again?
What was this guy's name?
His name is Howie Carr.
Okay, somebody tell Howie Carr to call in, okay? Howie, you've heard some fighting words here from Tom. Howie, what's your problem? And you can call us, and then you can call Kevin and talk it over.
Can we do this? Because I just heard the other day that there's some guy that's on the same radio station with Michael Savage here locally that likes to take me to task and call me, I don't know, he calls the street sheet the bum bugle. And
you know, it's not really funny. But never mind. I mean, it's funny, but
I find it entirely amusing that people have nothing better to concern themselves with than my silly little life.
You know, I'd find it funnier if we were the ones running the media and instead of the ones just desperately trying to get our voices heard at all. But be that as it may, let's take another call. The numbers are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Glenn from Utica, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you very much for your patience. What's on your mind tonight, Glenn?
Well, first I wanted to say I agree with, you know, your cause, even though I didn't use it, because, you know, I'm the type that's got to succeed no matter what, so. and secondly, I believe that most of this is choices, okay? What I mean by that is each person has a choice, you know, every choice they make, it's cause and effect, okay? Like I heard someone earlier stating that they had a $500 credit card bill. Well, if they can't pay a $500 credit card bill, how can they pay a $500 rent or a $300 rent every month? If they can't take care of responsibility, how can they take care of responsibility of a rent?
Somebody want to answer this?
Yeah, I'd like to say something about that. You're talking about personal choices, but those take place in the context of social opportunities or lack thereof. For instance, if you have low wages and high rents, then a person is going to have a harder time doing what you call responsibly paying their credit card cost and then being able to qualify for housing because they're shown to be solid.
Then they need to make a choice of either not using the credit card or to pay the rent.
Well, they might also have to, here's the way I look at it. It's also necessary to agitate for affordable rents and for living wages. And when we talk about poor people's choices, it's a different range of choices than those who have college degrees or come from the suburbs. And if we happen to be white or male, we have a different range of choices than men of color or than single women with children. That the society does deal a dirty deck, in my opinion, and even if it doesn't, the responsibility we have to play our cards right varies. Our options vary depending on which cards are dealt to us. So if you live in a society where women don't make as much as men for the same work, then that's going to create more problems for women. If you live in a society where black men are feared as predators, then they're not going to have as much opportunity for education or for housing. If you live in a society where people with a drug problem are imprisoned rather than given health care and detox,
you're going to Pluto.
Then they're going to have
you're talking about Pluto. Okay.
All right. Glenn, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Supposing you were poor, but you had a credit card. Maybe
I am definitely not rich.
Okay. But let's say there's a lot of people who are poor who ever had enough money that they could get a credit card. Then they lost their job or their circumstances changed, whatever. And you're there and you've got not enough money to pay for food for your kids. Just take an example.
Been there, did that.
And you got a credit card. Well, maybe you don't know how you're going to pay it in the end, but would you feed your kids with that? Would you go to the market and buy food for your kids with that credit card, or would you say no and let your kids go hungry? What would you do?
No, I would use resources within the society first.
Okay.
Such as food shelves and churches.
All right. Well, let's pick something else then. Your heat bill. You got to pay for your heat. And your heating company, your heating oil company will take that credit card and you can keep the heat in your apartment. You don't qualify.
Yeah, but for how long?
Well, that's a good question, but the point is you got a choice today. You either use that credit card to pay for heat to keep your children warm, not knowing how you'll ever pay it off, but you either give them that credit card and cross your fingers, or you're out of luck and your apartment is cold. Which are you going to do?
All I'm saying is okay, I'm going by what my father taught me, okay? I'm an educated man.
Yeah.
You know, I got a bachelor's in social science, and I'm working on a master's in social work, okay? And, you know, My father says, you know, no one's going to help you unless you help yourself first. I was taught that from early on. And responsibility, responsibility, responsibility. Okay, that's how I was taught. That's how I was raised.
I'm not arguing with that. And I think that is a fine philosophy. I don't want to knock it in the slightest. But I want to come back.
I've been homeless. I'm going to get into my story in a minute.
Yeah, okay.
I worked at this place called Hitchens Manufacturing Company, which I think everybody knows of because they make the Big Bertha golf clubs.
Okay.
They decided to move to Mexico for cheaper wages and less taxes. So thus, I was laid off and out of work. And I ended up being a supervisor there after about 6 years of my employment. After about 12 years, they decided to move. So this brings us up to about year 2000. Well, I drained out my bank accounts. I attempted to use my 401k until I found out that they were going to, you know, just to survive, until I found out that they were going to take 60% of it for early release of the funds.
Right.
So I ended up being homeless for about 2.5 years.
So you've really been there, and you know the score. I'm just coming back to this one point you made about choices. What if the choice is between using your credit card or your kids are going to freeze in your apartment? I mean, sometimes people don't have good choices. Even if they do the wrong thing, maybe they just didn't have good choices. You've been there.
Well, here's what I think what happened to me, okay? And this is one thing that everybody forgets about. Like, you know, I'm a Christian, too.
Okay.
Okay. I was ignoring God. Okay, I wasn't going to church, you know, and I wasn't praying, and I wasn't thanking him for everything that he has given me. And so he humbled me. He says, okay, you don't want to accept of what I've given you and taking it gracefully and thank me for it? He put me out on the street.
You said that the boss you had or the corporation you worked for relocated its work out of the country?
Yes, in Mexico.
And you were laid off. Now, did God make that decision for your job to move?
Well, everybody knows that Lucifer rules the earth.
all right, I'm not laughing at you. I'm just saying, oh, we got another party heard from now, you know. But it's okay.
But anyway.
But so even if it was Lucifer, you learned a message, and I don't knock that at all, Glenn. I mean, whatever causes our adversity, that doesn't mean we can't learn some spiritual lesson from it.
Well, anyway, I continued to look for employment. I went to this happened in Littleton, New Hampshire, by the way,
mm-hmm.
New England, the poorest part of the state, poorest part of the union, as we all know. I went to a place called Littleton Coin. Well, when they saw my documentation of my education, you know, with a bachelor's degree in social science, they decided that I was overqualified for their job because they only had laborers.
Well, Glenn, I want to congratulate you for getting out of homelessness. I wish I had more time, but we got people waiting.
Okay, just one more thing. Anyway, how I succeeded by moving to Utica, buying, they have what they call a low-cost home where the city takes over because still you're paying taxes.
Uh-huh.
I got a job where I make approximately $3,600 a month now, and I'm in my home, and it's, you know, comfortable. However, the other end of the spectrum is now I have a mountain of bills, $500 a month for heat, $80 a month for
there
electricity.
There you go. It's not cheap.
$76 a month for lights, and then I got a small mortgage. So, you know.
It's tough to make it these days. Glenn, thank you very much for the call. Those numbers to call in again are 877-NOBODY-8866 left out. And in the tower, we have Anthony. Anthony, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you.
What's on your mind, Anthony?
I'm going to recite a couple more poems.
Okay. Anthony, listen, just one short one, because you've been on before, so just one short one.
All right, the name of this one is Fascinations. Fascinations, procrastinations, and hesitations getting me nowhere. Following dreams, deceived by schemes, losing out and ending up with no care. It seems like I'm rolling on a flat with no spare. On a long, dark road, on a night so cold with precipitation in the air. Wishing upon the stars for someone to find where we are. Those stranded and branded by life scars. Sometimes feeling as though I'm on a distant planet as far away from civilization as Mars. with no hope as if I was stuck on a sinking boat 100 miles from shore. I might as well start swimming, the clock is ticking, and neither life or death is behind the door. So no time to fascinate, procrastinate, or hesitate, because I might end up shark's bait and get ate by that great white lie that's so deceiving to the eye.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you very much. That's very good. 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Those are the numbers to call. Kathy from Los Angeles, welcome to the marathon.
Hi, thanks. First, I'd like to say, yes, Anthony, you tell it. That was great. My story is that I was homeless for about a year and a half because my husband lost his job and I didn't have any family, and he divorced me, just moved on, and I didn't have any resources. So I lived in my car. But I would like to say that because I'm white and because I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood, I could think farther outside of a box than somebody, let's say, from Watts. Who, do you know what I mean? So I'd really like to address the idea of choice, and I think it's a concept that is poorly understood in this country, that it really does depend upon how you were shaped as a child as to what size the canvas is from which you can draw your choices as an adult. And I was able to, you know, utilize, Los Angeles has some pretty nifty services, social services. I got care at Adelman Health Center for free. I was able to eat a lot. And when I needed to eat more, I went and volunteered at farmers markets, volunteered my time to work for food, extra food at the end of the farmers market. I mean, there's always...
You were resourceful.
Well, but I was raised that way.
I understand, and you had a sense of you could actually go up to somebody in a farmers market and ask them. Some people might not feel that empowered.
You know, so as a woman, I have advantages that way, but also as a middle-class person, I'm able to think that way.
Right.
I can think, oh, well, it's okay. I'll just go do it. What's the worst that could happen? They'll say no, and I'll go try something else. There's this one source employment thing where you can go use the telephone for free, use fax for free, Xerox for free. They train you in interview techniques. They get you interviews. There's jobs posted. But, you know, I'm white. So I know how to think that way. I know how to choose to go to, you know, use those resources.
Chance, Tom, you want to jump in on this anywhere?
Yes, I just want to say, in reference to our entire discussion, that we need to combine personal responsibility with institutional responsibility. The corporations and the government and the nonprofits also need to be responsible. We need for corporations to pay a living wage. We need social programs from the government to assure that people have education and housing and health care. We need the nonprofits not just to take money to oversee poor people, to get them to act responsibly, but we also need to make sure their material needs are met and that people can organize for social justice, because without that organizing, poor people will never get what they deserve any more than women or people of color have gotten what they deserved, except by organizing for justice.
Exactly. That you just made my point, that it's the people who are not white who need that kind of help, because when they slip through the cracks, their thought process doesn't include what a middle class or a white person's thought process was educated to be.
You know, Kathy, I'll tell you a quick story, and then I'm going to have to let you go. But you're touching on an interesting point. It's one we've covered on the marathon. There's so many topics, we can't get to them all every year. But when I was driving down to Connecticut late at night, and the road was pretty empty, and my mind is buzzing, and I'm kind of working on this wad of cash theory of ending homelessness, you know, and let's not get too carried away with drug treatment and supportive housing and, and people have to have a better attitude, and God should intervene, all of which may have a role, but if you give people a wad of cash, they'll get housing. So I was thinking all of this, and I pulled into the toll booth on the highway, and I said to the toll clerk, I said, tell me something. If you took the smelliest, dirtiest, most disgusting, just out and out, you know, drunken, filthy, homeless person, and you gave them a big box full of $100 bills, and they staggered with that box into the Waldorf Astoria, would the Waldorf Astoria rent them a room? And she thought for about 1 second, and she said, depends what the race of the person was. And she was black. She was a black toll taker. She said, depends on their race. And her point was, a black person wouldn't get far enough into that lobby to even show them the money.
Probably.
Well, it does make a difference. When you talk about white privilege, I don't know if she was right or not, but maybe a smelly, disgusting white person would have gotten into the lobby at least long enough to open the box. I don't know, but you raise a very good point, and I want to thank you for the call. Those numbers are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. And we have Liz from Utica, New York on the line. Liz, are you there?
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the media coverage.
Good. I'm glad we're back to that.
What?
Good. Go on.
I was homeless for a couple periods of time while my daughter was growing up. And the worst thing that I experienced about that is, you know, around the holidays, they want to trot the kids out.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was so, I mean, that hurt me a whole lot. And I never allowed my daughter to be part of that. But it was kind of humiliating to her, too. It was like there was this one time when we had just gotten off being homeless. And we were living in Chicago at the time. And her teacher actually wanted her to write an essay and read it in front of the class about living in a shelter. And I had to go into the school and tell that teacher, look, you know, you are not going to coerce my daughter into doing this, because it's just not going to happen, because that's an invasion of her privacy. And it's an incident that she wants to forget. And, you know, fortunately now, you know, it's like I have a home right now, and she's in the military right now. She's about to turn 20. But, you know, it's just like it's so hard sometimes to be, you know, you talk about making decisions, and I made the best decisions I could, and it's like I couldn't quite, I'm on disability right now, and I couldn't quite, you know, I mean, I was trying as hard as I could, but I had to fight depression, I had to fight all kinds of things, and it's like sometimes you get just to the edge, and you feel like, you know, yeah, this time it's really going to happen, and then something happens. Like there was one time I was, you know, one semester away from getting an associate's degree in child development. I had a new caseworker get on my case declaring that my Pell Grant was income, and if I didn't quit school right then and there, she was going to cut me off immediately. And, you know, when you're faced with something like that, I don't know what to say. You know, I mean, I wish...
Liz, we're out of time, unfortunately, but...
Yeah, I know.
I want to thank you very much for sharing that. Chance and Tom, we only got a few seconds left, but would you say you've noticed this, too? Stories about homeless people come out between Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's when we're supposed to feel sorry for everybody and the rest of the time, Declan?
Actually, I republished a story that was written by a reporter with the St. Petersburg Times about how charities often use the same stock image of the pitiful old white guy for their Thanksgiving and Christmas donation drives. It's the same ad companies, basically.
All right. We're out of time, I'm sorry to say, but Chance Martin of Street Sheet in San Francisco and Tom Boland of Homeless People's Network, look it up online, folks. Thank you very much.
You are listening to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with WPKN Community Radio in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating or affiliated radio stations. To view the webcast of this broadcast, order tapes, or contact Nobody after the show, go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org.